home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
And I'm Rob Watson. Garrett is off tonight, but we still have an exciting show for you. I am actually going to be talking to Anna Schlegel, and Anna has written a book about the global economy, and it's relevant from a lot of ways going on right now. One is the current election, where we have Donald Trump, who has been for the past year making comments about the economy and foreign trade and, painting a very two-dimensional thin picture of what's going on in the world, and that he is basically against a lot of that. And I'm going to ask Anna about how valid that is, and we'll have that discussion, because obviously on the Clinton side, I don't know if you noticed, but on the third debate, the person who hugged her immediately after the debate was actually somebody I work for now, which is Meg Whitman of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, one of the biggest technology companies, and our company is global. So literally you had the global economy hugging Hillary Clinton after the third debate. And so we're going to talk about that and what it takes to be global with the business models, and validate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But specifically in terms of LGBT people, where there are so many countries in the world where it is literally illegal to be gay. And we want to see how those play into this broadening economy. So without further ado, and I hope she's there because I'm pressing buttons that I'm a little bit of a novice on. Anna, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice talking to you guys. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, and there is only one of us guys.
hello.
I'm flying solo. Yeah, it's part of the fun part of this. We Garrett actually has some projects going on right now, so I'm kind of covering the bases for us.
Very good. Nice meeting
welcome.
You.
Welcome. So, Anna, you tell us a little bit about your background. Am I right in assuming that you are with Network Appliance right now? Is that correct?
That's right. Yes. My name is Anna Schlegel, and I'm a senior director of global engineering for NetApp, which is used to be known as Network Appliances, but it's NetApp. Yep. It's based
NetApp.
In San Diego.
So under full disclosure, I have worked for like at least two of your competitors. I used to work for Hitachi Data Systems, and I now work for Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. So we are very much in the same space.
That's right.
So I've
got
lots of questions for you on global economy.
That's right.
So what motivated you to write the book?
So I've always been in the globalization, the localization, or translation teams. I've worked at Cisco, and I've worked at VMware, I've worked at VeriSign, I've worked at Xerox, I've worked in different countries. When you're in different areas of the company, and I've been in the channel teams and the marketing teams and the product teams, and you start helping these companies go global, you see who does it well and what methodologies help the company, and you understand what a globalization team does. And so I started researching what does it take to take a company to international markets. And as I researching, I could see a lot of papers, and I could see a lot of blogs around global trade compliance, or maybe there's, global campaigns. But there was not one book or a place that would explain the whole puzzle, and it really is a puzzle, on what does it take to bring these companies to international markets. It's an incredible amount of orchestration in the back end. And so I couldn't find this book. I went onto Amazon.com and I found, you know, a handful of globalization books that deal with global trade compliance or, you know, the scary thoughts that Trump is putting in our heads of, you know, globalization is going to kill us all. And that's not the globalization that, you know, that I've seen in companies like HP or Dell or, and I have a lot of friends at HP and Dell. And therefore I said, you know, I'm going to start writing a book that will explain, you know, my experiences working in localization and product globalization, marketing, you know, technical publications, and what does it really take for all these mega, you know, executives to make this work.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, now I've been in the indirect channels, which, you know, I can say to you channels, and you and I know what we're talking about, but our listeners may not,
yeah.
Which, you know, channels and indirect channels are when you have a manufacturer, and obviously any given manufacturer cannot go out and literally sell to every customer. So they need other companies who will buy their products in quote unquote wholesale and then resell those products. And I'm kind of oversimplifying it, but in an indirect way through partners, through other companies, through retail, through, you know, system integrators or other ways that the product goes to market. But so let's talk a little bit about what has been the rhetoric of the election. And I loved how you just put it that, you know, Donald Trump is saying that globalization will kill us all. So what is your feedback to those who hear Donald Trump and go, oh my gosh, you know, it's like we've got to keep it all at home and, you know, it's a bad thing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
What purpose does globalization serve for Americans? And why does that make us wealthier rather than poorer?
Yeah. I want us to be really careful. I mean, the message from Donald Trump of like this make America great, and there is a lot of people suffering right now because our jobs are being outsourced and offshored. And I remember when I worked at Cisco, we had the first chief globalization officer, and I was so excited about it. But it took me like a week to figure out that what this gentleman was about to do was to outsource and offshore thousands of jobs
right.
into India. And so that part, I really did not like, you know. And I, myself, I've had to move a lot of my own team members due to cost-cutting measures to work from cheaper areas in the world. And so that is the part that is scary, and it's scary for a lot of us. And I think, you know, it's scary if it happens in your family, and it's scary if it happens to your colleagues, that you see them lose their work. Now, the other part of this is, and one can see this, and I've traveled, I've been in Africa many times, I've been in India many, many times, you're enabling them to grow as a society, on the other hand. And so it's a double-edged sword. It's very complicated. There are a lot of policies around the world that are hurting the states. You know, we take a lot of product into China as an example, where you have to deal with the Chinese government, and the Chinese government to play with an American company or a European company or any other Asian companies, they have very strict rules of how they're going to sell your product, how they're going to position your product, and they will most likely ask you to rebrand your product. And so all of this, these methodologies are very scary, and they're hurting, you know, American households. In the end, is if you see your friends losing their jobs, or if you see your product being recoded, rebranded, it's no longer an American product, right? Or being from whatever
Although
country
I would,
you
I
are.
Would counter that in that, mm-hmm. yes, that happens in the short term, but from what I've seen is that it actually requires, if Americans reskill and move away from the like a physical manufacturing job to something that is more, you know, the more of the broader jobs that are being created in the United States, that it actually will even out, that we're shifting over jobs because we're not, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, being a factory worker was a common thing in the United States to, to be that. And today, you know, you're more likely to report to a call center or to an online thing where you are actually, you know, handling things for, you know, people online. I mean, it's there's whole environments that have been created that, you know, if you had mentioned that when there were factory workers, they would have gone, you know, what's an online, what's an internet, what's a, you know, it, these whole places haven't, didn't occur. The other thing, and I'm sure you've seen this in high tech, is I've actually seen more shifting of jobs, not necessarily overseas, but out of some of the peak areas like Silicon Valley to North Carolina or to, you know, other states that have much more friendly economy, but, you know, it's still the United States. I mean, it's sort of like you know, if you're going to worry about that, I mean, especially where in a technology or an industry where, and I guess we're talking high tech, but, you know, it, a lot of the progressive industries, they're creating more and more opportunities for jobs that weren't even in people's imaginations before. So it's, and the people that I see that are suffering the most, to your point, and I agree there are those, are oftentimes the ones that don't realize that if they evolved into a different skill level and changed what they were doing, that there are opportunities. There are big opportunities sitting right there.
That's very true. That's very true. And companies do study, you know, a site strategy where you could envision, you know, leaving maybe the Silicon Valley and going into Wichita or going into RTP or going into lower cost areas where, by the way, people there have less attrition and less issues with retention. I mean, here in the Silicon Valley Bay Area, you know, people flop from job to job every few years, right?
Right.
And so when you look at HR numbers, the attrition and retention, and it's very complicated here in the States. I mean, who has not worked in, here in the Bay Area, who has not worked in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 places?
Right.
And so it's a whole other, you know, problem that we have here where you can see that in a place like, you know, in the middle of the United States, it's, everything is a little bit more stable, more calm. Retention and attrition numbers are very different.
Right.
And I wouldn't.
I was going to say, you and I both work for companies where, you know, it's like, it isn't like the old days where, you know, we show up, we sit there, we work there, and we're going to get a gold watch at the end of our career. You know, it's like the companies themselves, you know, are, you know, they're going to shift. And to your point, you know, it's like 1,000 jobs, buy overseas, you know, goodbye. Or they sell the company to someone else and, you know, boom, you know, it's, you're part of a merger and hope you make it out of that shakeout, or, you know, those, it's like this sort of sea of monoliths cascading in and around each other constantly.
That's right. And you need to be ahead of that. You need to always have a plan B and a plan C. And as what you were saying, you need to be up on the latest trends, and you need to have your resume ready, and you need to have your LinkedIn profile up and running, you know. And so that's just part of this today, the economy. It is a very online oriented, it is very social oriented. But at the same time, you need to be very globally aware of, you know, the potential that you could be reporting all of a sudden to somebody in China. For example, when I worked at VMware, we were changing the globalization team there. All of a sudden, we, you know, the team started reporting into China. And so it's a shock, and people are not used to this. And, you know, now we see more and more Chinese companies trying to make it here. I mean, you look at Lenovo, you look at Huawei. These are companies that were not very global a few years ago, but they learned the lesson really, really quickly, right? So they themselves are learning how to use the world to their advantage.
Right. And I want to segue into one part of the subject because it sort of fits the theme of our show here. And then I want to go back to some of the very specifics that you've written about. But mm-hmm. when, you know, the obviously this is rated LGBT radio. And in the world environment, there are many countries that are, you know, a few years ago, they were just kind of, we just said, oh, third world countries, you know, and they were kind of off doing their own thing. Now they're folding into the global economy. They are places where the United States is considering, you know, offshoring or building parts of the company and all that stuff. You know, we've just now achieved in the United States marriage equality. You know, we have protections in a lot of companies, especially in the Silicon Valley ones, of, you know, non-discrimination against, you know, women, against gay people. You know, it's, you know, they're, those are now standards here. However, a lot of the countries we're talking about this globalization towards are not on board with that. And in some places, you know, there are countries where, you know, literally, you know, if I tried to move with, you know, my then partner and my kids and, you know, we were going to relocate to Uganda, we might be in trouble. How is that working?
That's right. So as I was doing a little bit of research to come to your show, I was a little bit in shock. I mean, I think we've seen a lot of progress here in the States, especially in the last 5-10 years. But we're very isolated here. We're very advanced in so many manners and ways. You know, it's not again, and I've lived in very scary areas of the world. We are very advanced here in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. As I was doing the research, I was learning that there's about 74, 76 countries where, you know, same sex is actually an offense or a criminal offense.
Right.
And I was learning that there's 13 countries where it's actually punishable by death. And so when you think about this, you know, we are such a diverse population in the world. The countries that I was researching were, you know, Afghanistan or Pakistan or Sudan or Saudi Arabia, part of Somalia, you know, part of Syria, Nigeria. The globalization that I've run at Cisco or at VMware or at NetApp or, you know, Xerox, are we typically don't play with these countries. I know there's many other countries, probably some of the areas of the old Soviet Union, where it's probably still illegal to, you know, be gay or bisexual.
Right.
Or, yeah, actually there was the case of these pop group, right, in Russia, that they all ended up in jail because they were protesting and showing that they were gay.
Right, right.
But, yeah, so I think there is, the majority of the countries where being gay is punishable, you know, like places like Iran or places like Saudi Arabia or Yemen or, you know, Mauritania, places like this. I have never done business in these countries. I do know through another organization that I help, which is Women in Technology, where I do see, and I could imagine that there's incredible amount of trouble if you are gay or if you're a woman in technology. I mean, there's very little discussed. There's no rules. They have very little rights. And it's actually very scary. And when we talk to this woman, you know, the questions that they ask us and the liberties that we have here in the States and possibly here even more so in the Bay Area are really not to be taken for granted. And so it's always an honor, and I always feel very proud when, you know, we're part of a society here in the West Coast that pushes the envelope so hard in innovation, in gay issues, in women in technology, in gender, you know, equality and stuff like that.
Well, do you feel
that, yeah.
No, and what you're saying is fascinating. Do you feel that potentially, because you made the point that a lot of these countries, you know, the companies you and I work for do not, you know, invest in those countries because they're
no.
You know, both from, you know, the LGBT standpoint, but also, you know, women, you know, executives are, thank goodness, not uncommon. And, you know, they have to be able to do business. And so, you know, those kind of backward philosophies are counterproductive. Do you think that some of these countries will be dragged along into the modern age, not because it's the right thing to do, which would have been nice, but because they're just going to have to join the world economy?
Absolutely. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I can tell you that there's more and more people visiting from, you know, countries like, you know, Northern Africa or the Middle East. They're coming in every year to listen and to learn and to debate and to discuss things with the Silicon Valley innovators, Silicon Valley, all kinds of groups. And again, I get a good view into this because of Women in Technology. And so these people that visit us then go back and try to replicate, you know, labs and technology and management skills back in Egypt and back in Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria. But in a lot of these countries, you know, gay rights are very non-existent, right?
Right.
And so you have to keep trusting that these women and these people that are coming here and they're learning from us, or they're not learning from us. Sorry, I don't mean to be, you know, we're no better than they are. But
we have Donald Trump running for president. Yeah, we're kind of,
yeah,
you know, yeah.
We're great. You know, that eventually, you know, you need to see something to be able to emulate it. So I think if we can offer these role models and show how it can actually work, how actually two women married having children, you know, or two guys married having children, it's actually a very normal, okay thing here. And so if they get some exposure into that, maybe they can relate it back, right? I don't know if that's a very naive, you know, way of going at this, but there's got to be like the government and then the grassroots, right?
Right.
I know, though, that these governments are very, very set. These are very old traditions, you know, and I don't have the crystal ball on how this is going to happen, but you know, the same we saw here in the States, where just a few states where legalized same-sex marriage by popular vote, as an example, ended up, you know, growing and growing and growing. And I'm from Europe, where, you know, I grew up in Spain, where same-sex marriage was illegal in Spain, and then it became legal because Spain saw other countries within Europe doing this, and so.
Yeah.
There could be some effect there, you know, where the more we are, the better it's understood and the less scary it seems. I don't know. There's a lot of, I think there's a lot of unknowns. Like if people don't know something, it just creates all this fear, you know.
Right, right. Well, in Spain was actually very progressive and they kind of took the ball and ran with it because, I mean, they were legalizing marriage before many of the other European countries did. It is interesting because in the United States, we've had examples of this. Different states, Indiana and Arizona, for example, were trying to pass discrimination or discriminatory laws. And the reason they didn't, and I mean, Indiana actually passed it and then they backtracked on it, was because business came in and said, forget it. You know, we're pulling out. We're not going to do business with you. We're, you know, this is not acceptable. And those states with Arizona in particular, was a very conservative Republican governor, and she vetoed the legislation because part of her conservatism was to be pro-business, and she saw that there was a conflict, that it was not going to be pro-business to support discrimination. Mississippi went the other direction. They went with it anyway, which is really a tragedy, because if there was ever a state that needed to try to get some footing in the pro-business arena, I would think Mississippi would have been it.
Right. Right.
What do you see in countries like China and India, where they are, I don't think they are as scary from an LGBT perspective, but they're not exactly warm and friendly either.
You know, I'm not an expert in all of this. What I recall, you were talking about Spain. Spain had same-sex marriage. I think it was legally recognized in 2005. I recall back then, I was already living in the States, but it was a huge deal because I had some friends that, you know, were explaining this to me, where Spain, I think, became the third country in the world to allow same-sex couples to marry across the whole country. And
right.
I know the Netherlands and Belgium had done that before. I think China today does not recognize same-sex marriage nor civil unions. And I do have to tell you that I've had in my team men from China that were gay. Or are gay, sorry. And, you know, it's such a taboo, and you cannot even discuss it, and they can't hold hands. And I know that there's been polls inside of China to question, you know, the population support of same-sex marriage. I think the numbers, again, I don't know. This is government, you know, percentages and stuff like that. Where the numbers, according to them, were lower than 50%. So I know that they offer things like dependent residency status to same-sex foreign partners, or they allow for some legal foreign residents to live together. But I don't know much around this. I'm not an expert in this topic, but I do know that when you're there, you don't clearly see, you know, any, definitely not, you don't see people having or, you know, they might be walking side by side and be a gay couple. I don't know if the neighbors, you know, would denounce it or say anything. I'm not sure about that.
But within the companies themselves, and this is going to your point about building models that work across the globe, when a company goes into another nation like that and establishes a presence, who is dictating the structure and the environment and the culture of that company? Is it the company itself, or do they have to fold into the laws and culture of the in other words, if we have higher HR standards in the United States, do those get imposed in our companies that go to China, to India, to these other countries, or do we have to let go of things that are we consider discriminatory where they don't?
Right. So I've seen mainly the models that I have seen is HR will completely comply with local laws and culture appropriateness. There are things that companies choose to adopt from a specific country, and I'll give you an example that comes to mind. So intellectual property protection laws, as an example, the United Kingdom has some of the most strict laws on IP, and many companies will make every single country apply those laws. But when it comes to, you know, human resources in China, human resources in Japan, human resources in Russia, they really comply, you know, with what needs country. And so, for example, in France, when I worked at VMware, I realized that they clearly had, you know, the French unions behind the office. And so inside the office, you need to have a syndicate or a unionist represented in the office. So the governments make you follow their laws and rules and regulations, and companies need to clearly understand these and abide by that. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be successful.
Right. I think it's important, especially now in this day and age, that a lot of LGBT people who are in the corporate sphere make it clear to their management and sort of to the industry in general that how restrictive some of this is and what the effect is on talent. Because I know for me, and, you know, I'm not pointing a spotlight on myself saying I'm the valued high-tech talent, but, you know, I've got enough of that, you know, and I've got a resume and all that.
Right.
But before marriage equality came about, I was going to stay in California no matter what. And, to a point where, you know, I was working for a company called Marshall Industries in Southern California that was an industrial distributor, did semiconductors and all that sort of stuff. They were bought by one of the big distributors named Avnet that was out of
yes.
Arizona. And at the time,
yes.
and this is a number of years ago, I was not going to go. You know, I was not going to
mm-hmm.
stay with that company because my future would be hindered. At the time in California was getting more and more progressive on gay relationships with domestic partners. We hadn't gotten full marriage equality yet, but Arizona was completely backwards. And so it was like, culturally, I was not going to make that leap. And so fast forward to today, I think that it will impede companies, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, from their globalization in that they may go into other countries, but they're not going to make it a corporate office, or they're not going to put their highest
That's
talent
right.
there because of the culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, as you know, the list of countries that I was mentioning before were, you know, being gay is just a huge negative, you know, connotation. It's not even allowed. All of this is punishable by jail or death. Most United States countries don't want to do business there. You know, I would imagine, you know, oil companies or gas companies, you know, maybe transportation companies or shipping companies do business there. I think from a high-tech perspective, you don't see, you know, Facebook in Iran, or you don't see, you know, PayPal helping specific countries. And for us, you know, living here and trying to get a job somewhere else, or I would, you know, caution everybody to always, you know, make sure you research the country that you're going to live in. There's a lot of people being recruited to go and work in China, as an example, where you do need to know that same-sex unions have not formed part of the cultural tradition there, right? And so, yeah, you need to be aware, and companies are missing out, and the countries are missing out as well. But from their perspective, maybe they see it very differently, right? They
right.
have their own traditions and their own beliefs, and they believe that we are cuckoo and crazy. Right?
Right.
So it's always the perspective of from the other end.
What are your list of companies, apart from LGBT or women's rights issues and diversity, but what companies do you look at and say they have expanded in globalization effectively?
So these are companies that have clear mandates of globalization, where the CEO is going to give clear goals of going global. They're companies, and I'm going to say they've globalized well. They might have other issues, okay? They might have some legal issues, But a company that has globalized very well would be UPS or FedEx, or in the past it used to be DHL. If you look at Nike, I mean, and Nike has, you know, some gender issues and they're trying to correct some of that. But these are companies, they're extremely global and very well, you know, adapted into other countries. Nike is all over Latin America, Africa, Asia, Europe. I mean, my kids, when we travel, the first thing they want to do is go find a Nike store, right?
Right.
Although
I have
now,
to say, it really was depressing to me to go to England and go to the Tower of London and look over and see Burger King right there,
so sad. You know, I've landed in like in countries in Africa where you expect to see zebras and there's the Starbucks, right? And so that's the part that I really dislike about globalization, you know. And I remember when I lived in Catalonia, I had eye surgery. I had laser surgery. I used to wear glasses. And I came out of this clinic where I had my eye laser surgery. And the first thing I saw out of this hospital, this, you know, super clinic in Barcelona, was a Starbucks. It was the first Starbucks I saw in Barcelona, in like this beautiful Catalan city, with my first, you know, virgin brand new eyes. I see Starbucks and I'm like, oh no. And so
what is
that
wrong
was
with
already,
this picture? Yeah.
What is wrong? I'm like, that's not the first thing I should be seeing, you know.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Starbucks,
it's almost like this weird kind of graffiti around the world, because I was in a very quaint English village, and you're exactly right. It's like right down the middle of town, Starbucks. And it was, the one that was really also a trip, again, was in London, was Kentucky Fried Chicken in the heart of London. It was like
that's not good.
Didn't compute. I actually, just personal thing, segue is, when I was young, I was 10 years old, my family lived in Italy for 3.5 years. And so we traveled all over Europe. And, you know, I was 10 years old and I kind of missed America. And I missed, you know, like McDonald's hamburgers and stuff like that. And I remember going to England at that point and they had none of that. It was, none of the globalization had happened. And the closest they had were these things they called wimpy burgers. They were wimpy of Popeye theme. And that was
the big chain
in the UK at the time was wimpy. It was like, now it's McDonald's. So,
I have to tell you, when we go to Bangalore a lot, we go to India a lot with my team. And after you've been there for a few days, you know, everybody will start asking, like, can we go to the Hard Rock Cafe? I'm like, why? It's just, you know, there's something they're missing, you know, their European friends or their American atmosphere. It's pretty funny.
Right. Well, in globalization, let's ask the big question, though, on that. Is that part of the downside of globalization? Will, you know, 20 years from now, will we go around the globe and it'll all look like the United States?
There are many countries that are trying to fight that, right? I mean, if you look at Switzerland, you look at France, there's regulations of how many of these establishments they're trying to allow per square foot, you know. But it is true. I mean, it's up to the countries to allow for these sort of invasion and then take over. And it is very scary. And, well, we've seen this with language, right? I mean, English has taken over as the language of business. A lot of products that used to be localized in Chinese, the Chinese themselves now are starting to speak English better. And so many times, we do get the answer of, you know, when I ask, would you like this particular piece of software globalized? And they will say, well, we prefer that the operating system works well in China, but maybe the GUI or the interface can stay in English. And so it depends on the level of expertise of the people that are going to use your product. Obviously, if it's WeChat or if it's, you know, any online media, you do want to globalize that into the language for the, you know, the masses that are going to use that product. But if you have an engineered product from HP or data center product from IBM or VMware or Cisco or NetApp, that's a whole other story. The people using those products are highly skilled, you know, telecommunication engineers or systems engineers that are very comfortable with English today. And so that is also changing.
Yeah, it's interesting with that, because there's sort of these elements to in play in language, because bottom line is it is very, very expensive. I'm in communication, so this is sort of right in my bailiwick. But translation is hugely expensive, because it's not just throwing words into another language. The words have to be grammatically and, you know, colloquially effective, you know, in the right context. And, you know, it's very difficult to do. So it's either going to go, as you're pointing out, how English is becoming de facto, or some technology's got to come along to make it easy to, you know, we have these now translator engines, but even they're still pretty far away from what you would consider an effective, realistic translation. In a cost-effective way.
That's what we do. Mm-hmm. That's what my team does. A lot of this is try to understand what needs to be localized or translated, what methodologies we're going to use. Because the reality is, yes, translations are expensive, but the more you translate, you can create these repositories of translated content that you can reuse. And so there is this automation and this machine learning that is happening nowadays. It's called a machine translation,
right?
Where you can hire linguists and lexicographers to actually train these engines to do better and better with time and translate better and better and better. And basically, you're not going to get the perfect translation, but you're going to get the gist of the content, which is probably better than, you know, not understanding it at all.
Right.
And so
I was just going to say, it's going to be an interesting evolution to see whether the machine translations, get sophisticated enough, quickly enough, and, you know, and obviously inexpensively enough before the whole world is just speaking English.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's go over to brand, because I think you that's one of the models that you talked about, was branding on a global basis. What are the pitfalls?
Well, not translating and not localizing is a problem. And sometimes, so that would be one suggestion, you know, especially from a marketing or demand generation messaging, you do need to speak in the language of the customer. The fact that we're saying English is becoming a very well-known language, and a lot of kids and, you know, young people are very fluent in English. The reality is that the nuance of a language, if you don't live in that country, you know, can get lost very, very fast. You know, I've been in the States now for 25 years. I am Catalan. My mother language is Catalan. When I go back home and I, you know, I'm with my family and with my friends, that language skill is really not there. You know, I understand 100% what they're saying, but the minute I open my mouth, they're like, wow, you really left in the 80s, you know. And so they know I don't live there anymore. And so if you want to brand and market properly, you do need to localize properly, and you need to do it very carefully with, you know, marketing experts that are local and people from the country to review the content and the message and the tagline. So that would be, you know, one thing for people going global. You do want to have a very carefully studied message, because otherwise the customer will see that you didn't invest or that you're an American company and you didn't even try. And so that doesn't fly very well, you know, especially in places like France or Italy or Southern Europe, you know, we like our languages and we want to preserve our languages. And there is especially, you know, and I can speak for my family. I have family in Germany. I have family in Catalonia, where they're very scared when they hear Trump, you know, and these tactics, you know, they want to become even more Catalan or more German or more French, you know, and protect what they know and what's true to them. And they would definitely not want to see, you know, being overtaken by someone like Trump.
Right. No, I mean, there's so much going on in this election but, you know, just from that perspective, which ironically, I think would be one of the most immediate detrimental effects, but it's the one we probably talked about the least, you know, in terms of that kind of takeover is I really think that with a few quick missteps, we could go into like a worldwide recession based on, you know, just some of the things he's thrown out there is like that so severely won't work. I mean, it's, I've seen, and I'm sure you are knee deep in it, but just, you know, the market fluctuations on the value of different currencies can affect the bottom line of Wall Street and, you know, companies' performances. And
that's right.
Very subtle little thing compared to some of the things that he's suggested doing, which would be much more dramatic in terms of what the bottom line effectiveness. And, you know, where some people are, you know, it's like, oh, well, business and, you know, greed and all that. It's like, well, no, business, 401ks, retirement programs, you know, a lot of the things that people take for granted are also complete offshoots of Wall Street. I mean, we need a healthy Wall Street. I mean, it won't work without it. What about talent? What is a really good perspective for a company going global and their talent search?
Yeah, so I think I would always like to start from the top down. So companies need to really pay attention with the type of executives that they bring in. Executives have the budget and the buy-in and the roadmaps and the decision-making power. And so I always, you know, advise, or when I was writing the book, I did write a lot about, you know, the type of teams that I run, the globalization teams. But I think the second group that is very, very important in this equation are the executives. So you want to find talent that has seen globalization before. You want executive vice presidents to run, you know, the support teams and the product teams and the legal teams that know how things work in Japan, that know how things are working in Europe, that know the IP issues in, you know, in England. And so these guys or girls, you know, are going to make a huge difference for a company. If you put, for example, that has never traveled or that has never visited, you know, a lab center, has never spun off a test center in India or a test center in China, you're putting the company a little bit in jeopardy in the sense that, you know, you might be missing out opportunity to get to the international market faster. So
right.
You want talent, right, that has lived globalization before, that have worked outside, that have negotiated outside, that have, you know, I see a lot of executives traveling, you know, go visit a partner, visit a factory, get back into the hotel, go party, have these amazing dinners. And I always tell them, you know, like, why don't you spend an extra couple of days at the office talking to the employees, trying to understand what's happening there, you know, and trying to get their feedback on what could we do differently or what should we be doing better. And
right,
including
right.
The local talent into the discussions of headquarters is very, very important and very interesting as well. So there's a lot of companies.
Especially motivating the associates, both who work for you, plus, you know, the partnerships outside the company in the local market, the, you know, understanding the culture and the pressures and the expectations and the incentives and, you know, all of those things is, again, a lot of the things that make big difference are pretty subtle. And, you know, to your point, you know, you need to kind of rub elbows to get it sometimes.
That's right. And, you know, for a company to go global in style, you need pretty much every single executive to buy into it. Because the seamless experience for a user or customer in, let's say, in Russia, needs to be in Russian through support, through the products, through legal, through marketing, through professional services, through the channel. It cannot just be that maybe they read, you know, the marketing, you know, documentation or demand generation kit in Russian, and then when they try to read the instructions on how to install this product, is in English. So you want, or that they call the company because there's a support problem or they need to open a ticket and they cannot speak in Russian.
Right.
So it takes
right.
a full orchestration, and you want those executives understanding that, supporting that, and investing in that. And that is very, very difficult.
Let's, and before, because one of the things I always shock my guests with, and it's probably a good thing, but, you know, believe it or not, we are down to our final 8 minutes here on the show. I want to talk about the book. So the book is called Truly Global. Where can people get that?
You can get the book on Amazon, so just look for Truly Global, and last name is Schlegel, S-C-H-L-E-G-E-L, Truly Global. It's about 100 pages, and you can buy it on or download it as an EPUB or as a paperback, or there's the hard copy as well. But it's not a really big book. It's 100 pages.
And who in the organization or not in the organization would you recommend as your target audience? Who do you think is going to get the greatest value out of it?
I think inside a company, people that are driving global programs. So, for example, if you're a global marketeer, global channel, global support, your product needs to be entering a different country and you're in engineering, you should be reading this as well, because it talks a lot about how to code the product, the different things that you can do for the product to be more compliant, or the operating systems. And so it's very good for global corporate leaders. The other group of people that I wrote this for was for students. So anybody that is thinking of going into international studies or international marketing or politics, these really tries to give the insider look at the behind the scenes of how large companies operate to move into this international market, you know, and how do they deliver the product to the customer about through all these cultures and languages.
Yeah, they were the ones that I was thinking of. Is that I think in today's world, anybody who is in a business school, you know, thinking about going into business, if you're not picking up a book, you know, this book, Truly Global, you're missing out. You know, if you're not thinking about globalization, you're not really thinking about where the future is going. I have to tell you that just a few years ago, when I was with Hitachi Data Systems, my role there was similar to what it is now, but it is I was in charge of the whole communications platform for our partners globally. And so as part of my career development is I wanted to dig more into globalization and learn more. And, you know, it's like, you know, take additional business classes on it and everything else. And, oh, my gosh, they don't exist. They're just not there.
That's why I
had everybody looking for me.
That's right. I wish I would have had this 20 years ago, right?
So, I know. It actually blew my mind that, you know, it's – you know, I was looking at, you know, Harvard, you know, extracurricular, you know, their you know, the adult learning tracks and, you know, all these different things. And, you know, they had some things, but they were not what I was looking for in terms of just this, what you've written about in Truly Global. It's like, it is actually a unique subject of something that, whether or not Trump wins, he will make a mess of it. I don't think he's going to, but, and that means that I think we will move along in a progressive way, which, hopefully the world will adjust to, and it will be, incredibly beneficial, you know, for everyone. What would you say to a startup, to a smaller company, you know, in terms of Truly Global?
I think that companies, and I see a lot of startups getting all excited about their products and features and developing more features. I would say at some point, take a break of creating so many features and upgrades and migrations, and pretend that your product is already going global. Pretend your product needs to enter Japan. How would it work there? Would you be able to localize it? What would be the legal compliance issues that you would find? And so pretending, I think, and pseudo pretending that the product needs to go global would be really, really helpful, especially for developers, you know, developing the code with internationalization in mind is already a huge win, because you do see products that have been developed for 10, 15, 20 years that are hard-coded, and there's no way that these products can make it fast into any other country.
Right.
And so, so something like internationalizing your code, or pretending that you're putting a pricing model for, you know, for Germany. Germany is a huge market for most of our products, right? So pretend that you're going to localize and price and open a legal entity. What would it take? I think for startups to play with one country as they incubate, or they have these emerging products, it would be really, really smart for them.
And so we're down to our final 3 minutes. We've talked about going to Amazon to get Truly Global. Where else would people go to find out more about you?
Oh, about me. I mean, you can look on LinkedIn. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Anna Papallona, which is AnnaPapallona. And I tweet quite often. I have quite a bit of followers. You know, and we discuss a lot about, you know, globalization issues there as well.
Great. Well, I really want to thank you for joining me tonight. This has been great. I think this is show is going to be available in kind of a podcast format. So I hope people take advantage of it. I think they would learn a lot just by listening to what we've talked about. What have we not talked about in globalization that should be said in the final 2 minutes here?
I think globalization doesn't necessarily need to be scary. I think, you know, the United States has a lot of potential. I would like to see the U.S., you know, creating some rules so that we can keep more jobs here. And I think globalization can be well enacted with some simple tips, so that you can target the right countries and use the right methodologies to help your company. And I think anybody in a company can help, from, you know, hiring the right talent if you're in HR, coding the right way if you're an engineer, you know, learning more about, you know, global marketing if you're a marketeer, et cetera. So everybody owns a little bit of the piece of this puzzle, of this orchestration, you know, to
right.
go global.
Right.
Yep.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. It's been a joy having you on here. And thank you to our listeners. You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I'm Rob Watson. Big shout out to my co-host, Garrett Miller, and his hit album, Blonde Jesus. Make sure you get that on GarrettMiller.com. You will love it. And it's got a great Halloween anthem on it, the Witch Sisters, that are completely appropriate for this time of year. And you need it for your Halloween do that you are, I'm sure, working on at this point. So listen to us again next week. Anna, thank you again so much. And we will see you then.
Thank you, Rob. Bye-bye.